Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Another blast rocked the capital city of Sri Lanka this morning, this time as security forces tried to defuse explosives in a vehicle used by the people behind attacks yesterday that left nearly 300 dead and hundreds more injured. The bombings targeted churches and hotels across the country. Here's the mayor of the capital, Colombo, Rosie Senanaika, reacting to the attacks.
This is a very sad moment. This is a very cowardly attack. And it's not just an attack. It's a very gross, gruesome attack on humanity.
Authorities today said they were aware of threats by a little-known local domestic Islamist militant group. CNN senior international correspondent Ivan Watson joins us from Colombo. Ivan, there have been dozens of arrests already. What do we know so far about who was behind these attacks?
They haven't named any one organization. They have pointed to a warning that was shared between heads of different security departments earlier this month, saying that they got information from a foreign intelligence service warning about the possible threats of suicide attacks against Catholic churches and the Indian High Commission, the embassy here in Colombo, and saying that the threat was posed by a local extremist group called National Tawhid Jamaat. But previously, that group was linked to basically defacing a Buddhist statue. Nothing as ambitious and as deadly as the apparent coordinated series of attacks that rocked three separate cities of Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday, hitting three churches and three luxury hotels with just a staggering death toll, Jeremy.
Well, and all happening around the same time yesterday morning. Give us a sense of the scale of the attack.
I'm sitting right across from St. Anthony's Shrine. So this is one of the targets, a Catholic church in Colombo that was hit. And the force of the blast, and the authorities say it was a suicide bomber who walked in, knocked the terracotta roofing off of parts of the roof, shattered plate glass that's in shards on the ground, and this was just one of the targets. We're talking about a death toll of at least 290 as of Monday night, more than 500 people wounded. That is just staggering loss of life, a massive atrocity. Up the road from here is the Shangri-La Hotel, a five-star hotel that had its plate glass windows blown out by a blast in its cafe. What's really chilling is that when the security forces, in the hours after the initial series of coordinated blasts, were investigating a residence here in Colombo, there were more explosions that killed at least three police officers and wounded another, suggesting that the targets of their raid knew the cops would be coming and prepared for it. And that's why the security forces are somewhat on edge right now. There's going to be a curfew in effect at 8 p.m. local tonight.
Do they think that more attacks could unfold?
Clearly, they are worried about it, and we've watched them defusing and carrying out one controlled detonation less than 150 feet from the church that was targeted yesterday. They blew up a suspicious van. This is the bomb squad here. Mm-hmm. And the blast shattered more windows in this neighborhood and sent already very gun-shy residents into panic in the streets, which suggests to you and certainly to me how on edge everybody is right now after these attacks. The housing minister has described it as a brand new type of terrorism for Sri Lanka. And this country dealt with a very deadly civil war for decades up until 2009. So it has experienced political violence.
But there's no indication at this point, if I'm not mistaken, that this violence is in any way connected to the conflict that was going on in Sri Lanka 10 years ago during the civil war.
As one official put it to me, he's not going to rule out or include any organization as they conduct their investigation into this. It's hard to imagine that a little known group of local extremists who had previously been accused of defacing a statue, that they could have carried out a conspiracy on this scale. And that's why a health minister here has said that there must have been some kind of links to an international network to try to pull something like this off. Also, there was a public apology from a government spokesman that the previous warning that security chiefs received wasn't dealt with adequately, that there wasn't more protection for Catholic churches that appeared to have been the targets of a potential threat. As one official here put it, this was an example of negligence and incompetence.
Ivan, as we learn more about the victims, we do know that there are Americans among them, other people from Western countries who were in Sri Lanka, especially because some of these hotels were targeted. Give us a sense of what's going on. Are people now, family members, flying into the country to try to find out what happened to their loved ones or to visit them in the hospital, et cetera? What's the scene there like?
Amid the at least 290 people killed, there are at least 39 foreigners killed, and they come from countries like Turkey, China. We've identified one American victim, a man from Colorado named Dieter Kowalski. There are Indians killed as well as citizens of the United Kingdom. This was a series of attacks that was clearly targeting Catholic Christians from Sri Lanka as well as foreigners, because Sri Lanka has a growing tourism industry, and this is going to send jitters through an important source of foreign capital for this country.
That is CNN senior international correspondent Ivan Watson joining us from Colombo in Sri Lanka. Ivan, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, it is Earth Day, the 49th since the first one in 1970, organized just after an oil platform off California blew, dumping 100,000 barrels of crude into the Pacific. Clean water is still a challenge. The Clean Water Act was the federal law enacted to protect rivers and tributaries, but it's faced a lot of questions. The latest, a proposed rollback of some rules from the Obama administration that defined waters of the United States. Brett Jaspers from member station KJZZ in Arizona reports.
Hey, buddy, 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 buddy.
Good boy, thank you.
Nathan Rees is taking his German short-haired pointer, Bo, off trail to hike along Dude Creek in the Tonto National Forest northeast of Phoenix. I asked Rees to show me an ephemeral stream, a channel that is dry now but carries water every once in a while.
Here's a good example of an ephemeral stream that comes in that's probably not mapped because we see how small it is, but this contributes to Dude Creek that we're standing in right now that has water in it.
Rees works for the Arizona chapter of Trout Unlimited, the sportsman's group. It favors federal protection over ephemeral streams like this one, so industries would need a federal permit to build around it or discharge into it.
If there was a mining operation even a mile upstream from where the confluence is, and tailings are being dumped into this, you know, dry wash bed, when those heavy rains come, it's going to push all those tailings downstream. It's going to get pushed down into Drew Creek, which is going to go into the East Verde, into the Salt, down to the Phoenix Valley.
In legal terms, an ephemeral stream flows in response to precipitation. According to the EPA, almost 60% of U.S. streams outside of Alaska are ephemeral or intermittent, another category meaning streams that run seasonally.
The hook is waters of the United States. Those are the jurisdictional waters. Well, what does that mean? That definition has evolved tremendously over time.
Bethany Sullivan, a law professor at the University of Arizona, says Obama administration rules came after a 2006 Supreme Court case left no clear directive about which waterways fall under the Clean Water Act. So after studying the issue, the Obama-era EPA and Army Corps of Engineers went with what Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote.
The idea that waters that have a significant nexus with traditionally navigable waters should fall within the scope of the act.
And in 2015, regulators declared ephemeral streams should be protected because they have a significant nexus with downstream waters. But those Obama rules didn't last long. The Trump administration is now proposing a revision using a different, narrower definition of waters of the U.S. from the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Scalia said ephemeral streams shouldn't fall under the Clean Water Act. Spencer Camps is with the Home Builders Association of Central Arizona. He's happy with the revision.
The purpose and goal of the Clean Water Act was to protect water. If water doesn't remain there, you know, what is the need for a federal footprint to regulate that system?
Getting a federal permit under the Clean Water Act, Camp said, can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in engineering and legal services. And having less federal oversight does not mean no oversight.
The state plans on to, as I understand it, and can step in and regulate those waterways.
Maybe not, says Melinda Kasson, an attorney with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, a sportsman group in Colorado. She doesn't see states filling the breach here. Kasson argues state legislatures may be reluctant to pass any fee increases needed to improve regulation of ephemeral streams.
We have the Clean Water Act in part because the states had the authority to do this before, and they weren't getting the job done, and the Cuyahoga River burned and other things happened.
The Cuyahoga River in northeast Ohio famously caught fire in the late 1960s, precipitating the Clean Water Act. And ever since, there's been a vigorous debate over exactly how much federal oversight is needed. The public comment period on the proposed revision just wrapped up. The rule is not yet final, but in any event, lawsuits are likely. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Jaspers in Phoenix.
And here's some startling statistics. The number of people incarcerated in the U.S. has quintupled since the 1980s. In 2016, it was about 2.2 million people. And the U.S. imprisons people at nine times the rate of Germany. In fact, author Emily Bazelon writes in her new book that our embrace of mass incarceration may soon come to seem nearly as shameful as slavery does now. And she levels several charges at those who charge people, prosecutors. Her new book is Charge, the New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. She's also a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School, and a frequent legal analyst for Here and Now. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm just going to tick through some of the conclusions you come to. You say prosecutors have become too powerful. You say that the role of a prosecutor has become a stepping stone for a political office, and that is a problem, and that many prosecutors have tunnel vision. Start with the prosecutor as a stepping stone for a politician in a time when being tough on crime is something that wins office. Explain that thinking.
Right. So my criticism of the office of the prosecutor being a stepping stone to higher office reflects a kind of past conception of the office. That conception is that in order to be the DA, you have to be tough on crime. If that's our conception of the district attorney, then the way in which this then becomes a stepping stone to higher office is going to lead to more incarceration rather than a system that's fairer and that can start to cut back on these huge jail and prison numbers that we've amassed.
Well, and also that prosecutors often may have a sort of tunnel vision. And let's talk about one of the cases that you follow. This is a young man with a pseudonym. You've called him Kevin. Grows up in a really tough housing project. Another kid in the project, Chris, has been waving around a gun that he got on social media. He is not supposed to have a gun. He's been in trouble before. So the police officers come to get him. As the door opens, Kevin panics, wants to do the manly thing to protect his friends, and picks up the gun and tries to hide it. And off he goes into this rabbit warren of prosecution. How does your thinking about prosecutors play out in his case?
Well, I think that what's unusual about this case, nationally speaking, is that New York has heavy mandatory minimum prison sentences for possessing a gun. If you possess a loaded illegal gun, you are supposed to go to prison for 3.5 years. That's the most serious charge. And that kind of charge gives an enormous amount of power to prosecutors. They are able to force a lot of guilty pleas by threatening people with prison. And there's almost no discussion about why young men, almost all the people prosecuted in New York City are young Black men. And because there's such a heavy penalty and this crime is assumed to be a violent felony, even though having a gun doesn't mean that you actually used it, those things mean we never talk about why people have guns, well, whether they don't feel safe and whether they're looking for some form of protection. Even if that's a bad call, we're treating them as violent criminals as opposed to people who have life circumstances that explain some of the choices they're making.
Well, but as you explain, there's a reason for this. There are all sorts of programs that are being developed now, diversion programs, so that young men who maybe haven't been violent yet can, or women as well, can go through a program instead of jail. But in one very famous case, it did not work.
Right. So this is a problem of a high-profile case in New York City driving a lot of punishment. And this happens a lot, right? It goes back to Willie Horton. We see one terrible crime committed by someone who got a second chance, usually someone with dark skin who scares white people. And then we're willing to throw in the towel on programs that have a good success rate of reducing reoffending.
But Emily, is that fair? I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Because you obviously have a point of view in this book. But is that fair to the police officers and the prosecutors who often work hand in hand? This young man went through programs, was given these chances, and then shot and killed an officer.
Well, you're talking now about someone who was not a good representative of the people in my book. You're talking about a 30-year-old named Tyrone Howard. He had a long rap sheet. He'd been convicted of armed robbery and been implicated in a shooting. The judge who gave him a drug treatment program, this was not a gun offense, didn't know that he was implicated in the shooting, said, I'm giving you a second chance. And then, yes, a terrible crime happened. But that's not a representative case. Yeah. It's a terrible event. But the idea that that would mean that we would unravel all the efforts we're making toward reducing and ending mass incarceration, that seems to me, yes, like an overreaction.
Well, and then Kevin, did not have that rap sheet. Had just, as we said, done a stupid thing, picked up a gun. But he ended up with a prosecutor who was more reform-minded.
Yes, that's right. His case was in Brooklyn, where the district attorney, Eric Gonzalez, has been talking about making jail and prison a last resort. And so Kevin was given the opportunity for a second chance. It made a huge difference in his life. And yet, because of the ghost of Tyrone Howard, that is a political risky move for the DA's office to be making. And everyone's very aware of that.
Yeah. Now, talk about another young woman you follow, Nora. She was convicted and jailed for the murder of her mother. She had come home early in the morning, she said, and found her mother brutally murdered. She served 8 or 9 years. Was there ever any evidence that she'd murdered her mother?
There was no physical evidence, and the DNA from the crime scene excluded Nora and identified 2 unknown suspects who the police and prosecutors, as far as we know, never looked for. So it's a case in which a lot of suspicion swirled around Nora because of what's called circumstantial evidence. She had been out all night the night her mother was killed, and she also didn't have a father. Her father had been murdered 1.5 years earlier. And so all of those things made her vulnerable to being charged. And the reason she got out of prison was that the Tennessee Supreme Court reversed her conviction because a prosecutor withheld important evidence from the defense.
Well, and you say it made her vulnerable to be charged because there'd already been a murder in her family when there was no evidence. It feels in your telling that the reason she was charged is that there was a very tough on crime prosecutor in this case who, at least according to a Memphis judge, Lee Coffey, a former supervising prosecutor in the same county who looked at Amy Weirich's, the prosecutor's, evidence, said he never would have presented that case for an indictment. Does Amy Weirich, in your view, fit into your description of this tunnel vision where a prosecutor might feel, I'm not a bad person, so if I see this way, I must be right?
Yes, I think you are seeing that there. And, you know, one of the reasons why that part of Nora's story is so striking is that it feels so arbitrary, right? Your case could land on one prosecutor's desk and you wouldn't be indicted. Another prosecutor's desk, you end up convicted of murder. And that is a problem with prosecutors having so much power.
Just stay with the issue of prosecutors. And I'm sure some of them hearing this right now are very offended, you know, at this notion that they have tunnel vision or they got it wrong.
Sorry, Robin. Yeah. I haven't actually heard from I'm sure you're right. I'm sure there are people who I'm offended. One always does. I have not heard from any offended prosecutors since my book was released. And I think the reason is that I'm not painting with a broad brush. I want prosecutors to see how much power and responsibility they have, but I also know that most people go into this work thinking they are good people with high ethical standards, trying to do the best they can. It's just that a lot of them are operating in offices where the way you get rewarded is by winning big convictions and winning long sentences. So it's a systemic problem.
Look, this is an issue. Over-incarceration that's united, well, you know, President Trump and Van Jones. The Koch brothers have poured a lot of money into criminal justice reform. What about those voices who say
you know, this may save us money, as some conservatives want, in not having that many people incarcerated, but we still fear it's dangerous.
You know, I think those voices are just many fewer than they have been in the past. Crime is dropping in America. That has opened a window for rethinking our system. And there's a crucial insight here borne out by research, which is that when you send people to jail and prison, you're making them more likely in the longer run to commit more crimes afterward, because people come out of jail and prison with more trouble getting a job or housing and in more desperate circumstances. And so the idea that you could improve safety by making the system more fair as opposed to more punitive and increase people's faith in law enforcement, those are ways to make communities safer that we have really way underutilized in American society.
In fact, you have a checklist for changing the way things are. More jury trials, fewer plea deals, less difficulty in getting bail.
Yes. Reforming the cash bail system is a huge part of this picture. Two-thirds of the people held in jail right now across the country are there because they can't afford bail. That's 6 million people every year. So just thinking about reforming the pretrial process, these are people who are assumed innocent, right? That could have a big impact. And then there's also the other side. After you get out of prison and jail, we have these very long terms across the country of parole and probation. We put a lot of people back in jail for what are called technical violations, like you break your curfew or you leave the state without permission. These are not crimes. They're only infractions in the context of these five-year supervision periods that we're demanding.
Just very briefly, how are Kevin, again a pseudonym, and Nora?
Nora is in Brooklyn. She is going to community college right now. She is doing well. And Kevin is in his neighborhood in Brooklyn, and he is working.
Emily Bazelon, author of Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced today that the U.S. is ending its policy of letting a select few countries buy oil from Iran.
Last November, we granted exemptions from our sanctions to 7 countries and to Taiwan. With this is to give our allies and partners to wean themselves off of Iranian oil and to assure a well-supplied oil market. Today, I'm announcing that we will no longer grant any exemptions. We're going to zero.
For more, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So, first of all, what exactly is the U.S. going to do now if a country decides it still wants to buy oil from Iran?
It would impose economic penalties on any companies or financial institutions that continue to take part in transactions linked to buying Iranian oil. And so here's the key. These countries could lose access to the all-important U.S. financial system and also the ability to do business with the U.S. or U.S. companies.
So China and India are the two biggest countries that have received waivers in the past. They would now no longer have those waivers. What would the impact be there?
Well, I want to just focus on China specifically because obviously we have so much going on with China. These trade talks are still going on, and they certainly complicate efforts to sever the Beijing ties to Tehran. There's also been some notion that perhaps there could be a workaround, a carve-out. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he did not actually rule out the possibility of some sort of limited exemption. So maybe there's a pathway there.
So there are big questions about what all of this is going to mean for oil prices around the world. The White House is already saying, oh, Saudi Arabia and the UAE will pump more oil to pick up some of the slack. Is that as simple as it sounds?
Probably not, because nothing is, right? The Saudi energy minister said that the country would coordinate with fellow oil producers to, quote, ensure adequate supplies are available to consumers. But, you know, honestly, there's not a lot of information here. And don't forget that Saudi Arabia, which is part of OPEC, has been part of an effort since the beginning of the year to tighten up supply and increase prices. And that's part of the reason why prices had been rising even before this announcement.
So what are we expecting when it comes to what will happen with not only oil prices, but also gas prices, which tend to follow oil prices up when they go higher?
You know, when you look at the prices since the beginning of the year, crude oil, both the global market with Brent crude futures and the U.S. market, the intermediate term crude oil, trending higher. If you look at the year to date, coming into today's session, Brent risen by more than a third this year. U.S. crude oil has soared more than 44%. We're about $65 a barrel. And this has indeed translated already to higher prices at the pump. 59% of a gallon of gas is determined by the price of crude oil. The Energy Information Administration said that during the first week of January, we were paying about, on average, $2.24 a gallon. By mid-April, the price was already $2.83. I hate to say this, but if prices keep rising, we can expect that your summer road trip might get a bit more expensive before you head out. You're going to have to look at different routes, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. By the way, I was just in California where it's already like $4 a gallon.
Yeah, it's
a different
insane,
world.
Right?
All right. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News. Thank you.
Take care.
You may have heard Ken Feinberg here in the past. He led the programs to compensate victims of 9/11, the Virginia Tech massacre, the Boston Marathon bombings, the Orlando nightclub shooting. He and his longtime associate Camille Byros have worked together since he was Senator Ted Kennedy's chief of staff and she was Ken's assistant in 1979. Now they work out of a six-person law firm in D.C. He's become known as the compensation czar, but she is the czarina, or more important in their recent project, the High Priestess, because now their independent reconciliation and compensation program has been processing clergy sex abuse claims for the Catholic Church. Dioceses in Pennsylvania and New Jersey have signed on. Colorado and California are reportedly expected to. They will put up the money, which most of New York dioceses are already doing. More than 1,300 claims from five dioceses have been processed. More than 1,100 of them have been paid. More than $215 million distributed to victims. Ken and Camille's model has become the standard for clergy sex abuse compensation worldwide. And it's Camille who hears most of the victims' claims of abuse, sort of reverse confessions. She joins us now. Camille, this must be hard.
It's very difficult to listen to men who are 65 years old and older who explain what happened to them, and it's as if it happened yesterday.
Yeah, burst into tears. In your office. But how do you do this? Because in some of the compensation programs you've run, it's quite obvious that somebody has died in the 9/11 attacks or the Orlando shooting. And we know that Ken had a formula for this mediation. He talked about it in his 2005 book, What is Life Worth? One of the toughest questions ever. But there's a formula for how long somebody worked, what children they had, what the family expected in income. What do you do when it's someone who's sitting in front of you who's, first of all, a victim survivor? You have to figure out what they are owed, but also you have to figure out whether to believe them.
We look at a number of different factors. First of all, we look at the documentation submitted with the paperwork. At the option of the claimant, we will sit in a meeting with them and allow them to explain to us more details about the abuse.
Well, when you say documentation, it could be that they told a therapist and the therapist made a note of it or even told a friend.
That's exactly right. You know, it could be journal entries, it could be diary entries, it could be something that's not something that they produced post the implementation of these programs.
But what if there's nothing? Because this is such a secretive, shame-based thing. Most people don't have anything. And you say that you know within 30 seconds if someone's telling the truth.
In some cases, when the abuser is a recidivist abuser, we look to other cases, mm-hmm. other abuse by that particular individual, and we see if we can find a similar MO, if you will, or any other information about what the priest did to those other children. Mm-hmm. You know, did he provide alcohol and drugs, pornography? We look at every aspect of all of these cases to see if we can assist the claimant with coming through the program with some sort of corroboration.
Right.
There are a few cases that we did. The interview didn't provide any additional corroboration, and we rejected those claims.
Well, and if you approve it, and you approve most in this program, you'd also decide how much compensation, the nature of the abuse, how long it went on, how it affected the person's life?
And age, the frequency of the abuse. Did you take them away on a weekend trip to a vacation home? We look at the effects on the life. We look at whether he or she was able to maintain any personal intimate relationships as an adult. A lot of claimants question their own sexuality. Mm-hmm. So we look at all the material that's available to us to make a determination.
Well, again, what a horrendous tabulation to do. You know, what a horrible spreadsheet that must be, you know, to try to figure that out. But you have been giving compensation. But what do you say to critics who say, first of all, this was instituted by Cardinal Dolan of New York. He called up Ken and said, can we talk about this? At a time when there was an awareness that the law was about to be expanded so that more claimants could come forward because the age that someone would be allowed to make a claim, in other words, how far back the claim was about to be expanded. And so there were critics who said the church was just trying to get rid of a lot of these claims before they became public. But also that you are doing the business once again for this church of not forcing the church to be the one to have the conversations about what happened to the victims. All the information that you take in goes into a file. Your thoughts on that?
I have a couple of comments about that. We hear from many of the claimants when they come through this program that it's really not about the money and the compensation. It has everything to do with the acknowledgement by both myself and Ken Feinberg as the administrators of these programs that this, we believe them. We mm-hmm. believe this happened to them. We're not questioning that this happened to them. And they are grateful for that acknowledgement and validation of the fact that all these years they've been telling the story and now they're telling it and their people are believing it.
Yeah.
With regard to the changing of the law, when we first began this process with the Archdiocese of New York, that was in the fall of 2016, and it's my understanding that they had attempted a change in the statute for several years, and it didn't pass, as you well know, until this year. And quite frankly, that will give these victims another avenue. Once the law is in effect and they can bring suit, they can decide, do I want to come into this private program or do I want to actually file suit and go through that whole process of discovery and witnesses and a trial? And they have an option. They even have the option of coming into our program to see what our determination would be. And if they choose to accept it, they may. If they choose to reject it and move forward to a lawsuit, they can do that. So it gives them another option as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and it sounds as if you're also saying for the critics who say this is once again this Catholic Church not recognizing in a public way exactly what happened, the events that happened. We're reading the recent terrific New Yorker piece about the work that you and Ken do, but also it was written by a Catholic who would like to hear from church leaders the acts, the things that happened, like to have a recognition, because right now it's sort of cloaked in euphemism. But it sounds like you're saying for some of these victims, it gives them the privacy and the dignity of a conversation with you and Ken rather than the public airing.
I think it does. And, there are a number, it's not a large number, but there are a number of victims who ask if we can facilitate a meeting with the bishop of the particular diocese or the cardinal in the case of the archdiocese. And, we have done so. There aren't a tremendous number who want to go back to the church and have these discussions.
Well, and we should also point out that through your work, you and Ken, you picked up on claims against Theodore McCarrick and delivered those directly to the church, which did its own investigation. And it turns out that there were many claims against this bishop.
The first claim was filed with our program, and you're absolutely correct. It immediately went through the internal review board of the archdiocese, and since it involved a cardinal, it went to all the way up to the Vatican for their review and investigation process.
Yeah. As you listen to these stories, are you a Catholic?
I raised a Catholic. I am a lapsed Catholic.
Your sense of, you know, as you hear story after story, and your compensation program is, as we said, expanding, your sense of the church and your sense of faith and your sense of what's happened here.
A lot of these victims are completely estranged from the church, but there are a number that still believe and want to maintain a relationship. So it's very difficult.
Yeah. And I would just close with, unlike a lot of settlements, legal settlements, your reconciliation and compensation program doesn't require that people who receive compensation then not talk.
That's right. The program and the administrators are bound by confidentiality. The claimant and the victim, on the other hand, can say whatever they wish to. They can tell the news media. They can stand on the cathedral steps. They can do whatever they want to do because they are not bound. They are free to speak about the abuser, the process, the money, the church, whatever they wish.
That's Camille Byros, a longtime assistant to Ken Feinberg. She and he oversee compensation programs for victims of clergy sex abuse, and she's the one who most often hears their stories. Tough work. Camille, thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
In the age of cell phones, it's possible to keep your phone number even when you move to a city and a new area code, and many people choose to do this. Some for sentimental reasons, some for more practical reasons. What that means is, let's say you've got a 312, Chicago, but you move to 202, Washington, D.C., everyone you give your number to knows a little something about you. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's been thinking about this. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I know because I have your cell phone number that it does not currently match the city you live in, which is New York.
That's right. My area code is 703 because I'm from Northern Virginia, and I still have the same number that I got when I was put on my family plan some 15 years ago. to answer the question with extreme literalness, my area code is just a fact of my coming from McLean, Virginia. But it's kind of neat because area codes are a little bit like hometown souvenirs. They're artifacts of our past, especially in a city like New York or maybe Boston, Los Angeles, D.C., where you have a lot of young people moving there to start their careers. They are bringing their hometown code with them. In a place like Arizona or Florida, too, where you have older people moving there to retire, they're bringing their zip codes there. So the zip codes in our phone number are little codes of provenance that we take with us when we move, and I think that's kind of neat.
A little mystique. I mean, I have a 617, but not because I'm in Boston now, but because I got it when I was in college in Boston. Then I moved to New York and D.C. and L.A., and all along the way, I had a 617. Everybody knew there was some, and now they all just think I've lived here my whole life.
Right. That's typically the thing. Either this is your hometown, or it's where you got a particular cell phone plan when you were in college. So one or the other. It tells you something about your resume and where you're from.
What are some of the reasons people decide to keep their old phone numbers when they move to a new state or a new city? It used to be, back in the earlier days of cell phones, that you actually had to get a new one when you would get a new plan. If you would be in a different place, you would have to get a new one. Now people are able to keep them. Is it just about convenience? They don't want to change their phone numbers every business they're associated with?
I do think it's almost entirely about convenience. Mm-hmm. I would love to wax poetic about how zip codes are little bits of hometown DNA, but the fact is that most people keep their old phone number because changing it is such a huge pain. It's extra work for you. It's extra work for the people that you know. You got to email your contacts and update them in the new phone number. I mean, you know, who needs one more hassle in life? But I think it's also important to point out that phone numbers just aren't as important as they used to
right.
be. There are just more ways to reach people. So, you know, Jeremy, if you're in New York and you want to meet for coffee or a drink, you can call me, but that would actually be a little bit weird. I might think there's some sort of emergency with the segment we're about to do. You probably won't call. You'll email. You have the option to reach out on Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp. You could DM me on Twitter because we follow each other. Or you could do the totally normal thing and text me. And there I imagine you'll search for my name under D-E-R, not 703. Mm-hmm. And so this gets to the last irony of phone numbers, which is that in this era of text and saved names, we don't have to remember numbers the way we used to. I mean, I had dated my girlfriend, I think, for 2 years before I was forced to memorize her phone number. It wasn't because we weren't talking every single day multiple times a day. There was just less of a need because I would just type in her name to text her, and the phone number just wasn't an essential thing to remember.
Which brings me to another really weird part of this, because that you're right. A phone number doesn't matter as much as it used to anymore. And yet, with all these scam calls, and I'm sure that our mm-hmm. listeners are all getting these scam calls all the time, it seems like the trick that they use is to get the number that they're calling from to be as close to your phone number, your actual phone number, as possible.
Yeah. It clicks back into this idea that in an age where you can always text to say something that is non-essential or non-emergency, there's a kind of assumption that a phone call out of the blue from someone that you know is rather an emergency, right? So I kid you not, as I was researching this article, I got a call from a 703 number. My number begins 703. That's Northern Virginia. I picked up the phone and the voice on the other end goes, this was 90 minutes ago, Hello. This is the dealer processing department. I'm calling about your vehicle's warranty. I don't own a vehicle, and I certainly don't have a warranty, so I knew it was fake. So through a tactic called ID spoofing, spammers can own several numbers. And what they do is, if I'm a spammer, I collect several numbers, and if I'm calling you, Jeremy, I'll use the 617 number that I mm-hmm. own. But if I'm calling New York, I might use a 212 number and so forth. So we're more likely to pick up when we see an area code that we recognize. A part of that is familiarity bias. A part of that might be, oh, is it someone from my past trying to reach out to me for whatever reason? And so that is indeed how these scammers get us today.
I always get the call from my local carpet cleaner. That's what they say. I'm with your local carpet cleaner. Derek, one more thing here. The bigger picture here, zooming out, is that people actually aren't moving as much as they used to, right? Adults.
That's true. So between 1970 and the 2010s, the rate of Americans moving between state actually fell by half, fell by 50%. There's two reasons, an obvious reason and a weird answer. The obvious reason is that as housing prices increase, it makes it harder for middle-class families to move near to major metro areas. So they're more likely to stay home. The weird answer is that cities are becoming more similar than they used to be. It used to be that if you wanted a healthcare job, there was a certain city you might move to. If you wanted to work in commodities, you'd move to Chicago. Mm-hmm. But today, if you want to work retail, consulting, a healthcare job, you can do it anywhere. Mm-hmm. In economic ease, you would say the industrial mix of cities is more similar. And as a result, people are essentially saying, I can do basically whatever I want to do in my city, so I'm not moving. And as a result, mobility is in decline.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Robin Young. It's Here and Now.